knowledge anytime by texting WPFWFM to 801-801, helping us to build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Greetings. This is Brother Jamil, host of Yardbird Suites. During this season of lights, we ask that you remember WPFW and the sustenance we provide to the community. You can give the gift of WPFW from December 15th through December 31st during our year-end membership campaign. It is indeed your generosity that has allowed WPFW to provide news, music, and information to the people since 1977. Donations can be made anytime at WPFW.org or by calling 800-222-9739. We wish you truth and peace now and in the new year.
I'm Elliot Gross, the host of the Don't Forget the Blues Hour. You are tuned to member-supported WPFW in Washington.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Community Watch and Comment here on WPFW 89.3. I'm Larry Stafford, Jr., Executive Director of Progressive Maryland, and of course, co-host of this Community Watch and Comment show alongside Dave Rabin this Tuesday morning. We've got a great show for you today with some important conversations about what's happening across Maryland. Plus, we are joined by our featured guest speaker today. Our guest for the day is Delegate Vaughn Stewart, right out of Montgomery County, straight out of MoCo, who will speak about things going on in this upcoming legislative session, the ill fate of the National Democratic Party and what happened in this previous election. But before we dive into those main topics, we're going to start with a quick roundup of some of the latest news that's making waves in our state. And of course, I want to let everyone know that you can join us by calling 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893. You can call in and join in on the conversation as well. And so I'm also here with our co-host of the show, Dave Rabin, and we have our fundraising drive going on, as I'm sure you know, listening to WPFW. And Dave,
go ahead. It's kind of unavoidable, huh?
Yeah, absolutely unavoidable. We mean to make it unavoidable for you. So,
we're operating from a different model. You're not inundated with capitalistic commercials. You're inundated with the love and concern of programmers such as Larry and myself. We're not making a dime from this. This is a labor of love. We're interested in getting you important information, both locally, nationally, internationally, information that you, for the most part, can't get anywhere else. Larry's going to run down local news in a way that you aren't hearing on DC area's airways. And I think it's very important. I know it's very important for you all to step up. This is a labor of love for us, and we need you to show the love, particularly right now. We're in the process of moving, and it costs over $100,000 a month.
Sorry, Dave, I think you're breaking up.
a little bit. Please show the love.
Yeah, I think Dave is breaking up a little bit, but that's okay. That is another reason why we need your support right here. Maybe for help with our Wi-Fi as well, right? So you hear this type of news only on WPFW, and you know, just to add to what Dave is sharing, you know, it's absolutely critical that you contribute here today with WPFW. And so you can call in once again at 202-588-0893, and we'll get Dave back on in just a moment. And so before we go further into our pitch today, or we're going to our show today, we're going to get into some local headlines, actually. So first up, a major development in Maryland's education system. Governor Wes Moore has announced plans to pause parts of the Blueprints for Maryland's Future, the sweeping education spending plan passed in 2020, citing a projected $2.7 billion budget deficit. Moore said that the pause is necessary to reassess certain programs, like one designed to give teachers more planning time, a move requiring hiring more educators amidst a statewide teacher shortage. And education advocates like Prince George's County Educators Association President Donna Christie made arguments that the blueprint is a package deal and fragmenting it could undermine its goals. And the pause is concerning because the blueprint was designed to address systemic inequities in Maryland's education system. And my hope is that the budget shortfalls don't become excuses to backtrack on implementing the blueprint for our children's future and supporting our hardworking teachers. So while we're on the topic of education, there is actually a heartwarming story coming out of Prince George's County. A local restaurant, Little Minor Taco, has stepped up to tackle student lunch debt. On Giving Tuesday, the Brentwood Eatery pledged 100% of its proceeds from their kids' menu to help eliminate school meal debt in Prince George's County Public Schools. So that's absolutely phenomenal. 100% of their proceeds are going to go towards eliminating school meal debt, and which is a concept that I just find absolutely horrendous, that children are going to school and accumulating debt. Like, are we really having, like, children as young as 5 years old, like, already in debt? I mean, I thought that at least had to wait until adulthood. So with affordable $3 kids meals like quesadillas and rice bowls, the initiative shows how local businesses can play a big role in addressing community challenges. So hats off to Little Minor Taco for stepping up and leading the way. And no child should have to worry about whether they can afford to eat. And this is a reminder that we need systemic solutions to end food insecurity, not just schools, but across our communities, actually. Shifting gears once again, Maryland continues to confront challenges related to mass incarceration. The Maryland Equitable Justice Collaborative recently released 18 recommendations to address racial disparities and other systemic issues, with Black Marylanders making up 71% of those incarcerated, but only 32% of the population. The recommendations call for everything from enhancing data transparency to reducing unnecessary police interactions and rethinking parole for aging individuals. One standout proposal, downgrading certain traffic violations to secondary offenses to limit unnecessary police stops. Not everyone is on board, though. The Maryland Sheriff's Association, of course, has already labeled the idea ridiculous. It'll be interesting to see which, if any, of these reforms gain traction in the upcoming legislative session. This is what transformative justice can look like. acknowledging the systemic inequities that have devastated Black and Brown communities and putting forward real data-driven solutions. Furthermore, in other news, there's some uncertainty surrounding healthcare across the state of Maryland in terms of access, particularly for Maryland's DACA recipients. A recent federal court ruling could jeopardize their ability to purchase health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. For now, though, Maryland plans to maintain coverage, but the legal landscape is shifting, and that could change. It's another reminder of how policy decisions can directly impact thousands of lives right here in our community. So with that said, do we have Dave back here? Dave, you're back on?
Now I'm unmuted.
Well, yeah, unwavering one of our headlines. Wanted to make sure we had you a chance to finish what you were saying.
Oh, it's just, I don't want to belabor it, but we're offering a certain kind of programming on Community Watch and Comment, the Tuesday edition, that we think is a wonderful combination of Larry providing local news, Prince George's County is the largest section, I believe, of our listenership, and it's not getting enough attention, and Larry is providing it, I think, in a very important and fruitful way. He's also providing information about Maryland at large, and we're heard all the way up in Baltimore, and I'm doing my best to cover DC issues, other programmers are, but Maryland maybe gets a little short shrift. And it's great having Larry Stafford, the executive director of Progressive Maryland, on to fill us in on the important issues occurring locally in Maryland and across the state. I mean, talk about who your guest today, Larry. You've got Maryland State Delegate Devon Stewart. It's wonderful to have someone like that on. Are you with me, Larry?
Yeah, I'm right here. So we're going to get into our interview with Maryland State Delegate Devon Stewart in just a moment. But I again wanted to emphasize, of course, that, WPFW is more than just like a radio station. To me, it's for years been like a family where we bring you the music that soothes your soul, the news that sharpens your mind, and the voices that speak to your heart. But to keep this essential community space alive, we need support. And right now, that's why we're asking you to stand with us, become a sustaining member, make a one-time donation, or to renew your commitment to the station that gives so much back to you. And every dollar makes a difference. So you can do that at wpfwfm.org/radio/support us. And Davis, do they have a call-in for today as well?
Yeah, and you don't need all the backslashes. Just wpfwfm.org, and then just hit the donate button. And when you get to the website, you can use your credit card or your debit card. Also, you can use PayPal that you'll see on the site there. And then you can call in, make the call. It makes the difference. 202-588-9739. That's 202-588-9739. We also do Cash App. That's $WPFWFM. So that's $WPFWFM. And we've got a new way that you can contribute to the wonderful community resource that is WPFW, 47 years and clicking. You can donate by text WPFWFM to 801-801. WPFWFM to 801-801. Anything you can give would be very, very much appreciated. No amount is too large. No amount is too small. Make a contribution to keep this station going. And we should say, as we're coming to the end of the tax year, it is tax deductible. Very important little ripple there. We love sustainers. Sign up for $10 a month. That'll give us $120 for the year. $20 a month will give us $240. you won't even notice it. And you can always, if you get into dire straits, end your sustained, sustainable membership. So please make the donation that makes a difference. We've got a $400 goal today. We need your help to get there. We've got a $75,000 goal for the entire drive. Please show the love. Please step up, 202-588-9739, or go online, wpfwfm.org. And let's get back to the wonderful content that Larry Stafford is providing.
Okay, so let's go into our interview with Delegate Vaughn Stewart, who has been right here with us patiently waiting. So we're joined by, as I said, Delegate Vaughn Stewart, who's representing District 19 in Montgomery County. And he's been a passionate leader and proud voice for Maryland residents as the only or one of the few Democratic Socialists elected to the House of Delegates. And since his election to the House of Delegates, when he was sworn in 2019, he's taken on critical issues like housing affordability, environmental justice, and government ethics. And he's not just a lawmaker, he is an activist and change maker. And so I'm glad to have you with us today, Delegate Stewart. Welcome to
Thanks very much, Larry. It's awesome to be here. I appreciate that introduction. And Dave, it's great to hear from you as well.
All right. So as we said at the top of the show, we wanted to get your perspective from the local level as a state representative, a member of the Democratic Party, but a much more progressive member and much more leftist member of the Democratic Party. Let's start from the top. Like, what do you feel went wrong with the national party's election chances? Looks like Democrats lost all of from the top to the bottom, right? The presidential race, they lost the Senate and the House. They don't have the judiciary anymore, right? And so we want to get your perspective on that, and of course that of our listeners, because you can call in at 202-588-0893 if you want to join in on the conversation. So just a quick reminder to our listeners there. So Delegate Stewart, let's start there.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, the election was obviously a disaster. It was a gut punch. Could have possibly gone a little bit worse. There were a couple of Senate swing seats that could have flipped to the Republicans that would have made the night even worse. But it was absolutely a calamitous night. If you care at all about labor or working people, if you care at all about public education, the judiciary, if you care about sensible, rational health policy, or if you care about turning the threat of climate change into good-paying jobs, it was a really bad night. And if you live in the D.C. metro area, like many of the listeners do, it's also a really scary time to have an economy in Maryland, Virginia, and D.C. that's so dependent on the federal government, given what the Trump administration is planning there. So, you know, my opinion is just one of many as to what went wrong. This is obviously a boom era for the think piece economy. It seems like every Democrat with a laptop and a mouth and some fingers, and maybe even some Republicans too, have thrown out their opinion about what went wrong. So, I mean, take it with a grain of salt. I mean, I think that the big disagreement that you see is this a platform problem? Is this a fundamental problem with the Democratic brand that involves a wholesale overhaul of the party? Or is this something a little bit more granular? Is this like a messaging problem where the Democrats need to start going on Joe Rogan's show and they need to start micro-targeting better on social media? And if they just make a couple tweaks here and there, they'll be okay. And so that's really, I think, what the divergence has been in the aftermath of November. It's like, is this a fundamental problem or is this a small tweak problem? And I think if you're looking at just presidential politics, if you're just looking at how do we win the presidency in 4 years, I think there's maybe a case to be made. I don't really agree with it, but I think there's maybe a case to be made that minor tweaks are fine, because Trump's victory was pretty narrow. You know, you're talking about tens of thousands of votes in a few states that flipped it. It was one of the most narrow popular vote victories in the nation's history. And I also think his administration, based on who he's picking, is very likely to overreach. He's picking a lot of his billionaire friends. I think just like last time, he's going to be trying to stuff as much money into the pockets of billionaires as he can. And I think just like last time, there's going to be a backlash to that. But what convinces me more of the need for more fundamental change about the for the Democratic Party is the Senate map. Because it's really hard to be an effective party if you can't get a trifecta. If you can't get the presidency and the House and the Senate all at the same time, it's going to be difficult for you to deliver on what you're promising the American people. And if you look at the Senate map, really the best case scenario for the Democrats right now, if you count up states where we're competitive, you know, states like North Carolina, states like Virginia, Colorado, you know, you add a Senate seat, a couple Senate seats in New England, maybe even you throw in a Alaska Senate seat, the peak, basically the ceiling of Democratic Senate votes is somewhere around 52 votes, which is terrifying. If you do the same kind of math for the Republicans, their cap, their ceiling is more like 62 votes, which is above that magical 60-vote filibuster-proof majority. It wasn't too long ago, you know, Larry, we don't even have to go back from the time when you and I were kids. It wasn't that long ago, say 5-10 years ago, where Democrats, even if they weren't winning, they were competitive in states like Arkansas, Louisiana, Missouri, Kansas, on the Senate level. And those days seem to be gone. And I think that to me is what calls out most strongly for more fundamental reform. And in terms of what that looks like, I mean, I think we have to be laser focused on helping working people and making sure this is a party for working people again, and making sure that the multiracial working class can afford to live their lives. And I can't guarantee that that's going to help us electorally. It certainly did for FDR. I think it will, but I can't guarantee it. But I think my argument would be, even if it doesn't help electorally, it helps people tangibly. And if the worst case scenario is that the Democrats gain zero votes from empowering working people in this country, then that's a deal I'm willing to take.
Got it. And once again, I want to remind listeners here, you can join in on this conversation by dialing in at 202-588-0893, 202-588-0893. So, I mean, it sounds to me, Delegate Stewart, like you've got some, do you have hope that these changes that you feel are necessary for the Democrats to be victorious will actually happen? Because what I see from my vantage point is like there are a lot of competing interests here. Some of the positions that perhaps would be more popular with voters regarding, you know, economic interests of people are just, you know, there's a sharp disagreement with the donor class of the Democratic Party. Like, what gives you any hope that some type of change would happen?
Yeah, I mean, you have to remain hopeful, you know, especially if you're silly enough like me to actually run for office and put your name on the ballot. Then at the point where you lose all hope and you think everything is going to hell, you might as well just kind of get out of the business at that point. So I always have hope. And I think my hope stems from looking at the last few years. You know, I mean, if you go back to where the Democratic Party sat in, say, 2010, 2011, 2014, I mean, you had an Obama administration. I was actually a White House intern during the Obama administration during that time. And, you know, I'll always have a very soft spot in my heart for President Obama. And I think he did a lot of amazing things during his 8 years. At the same time, if you look at the conversation that the Democrats were having internally at that time, it was a totally different and much more right-wing donor class conversation. I mean, there were even things like Social Security and Medicare cuts being proposed by the Democrats. They were taking a much less hostile tone towards Wall Street and towards billionaires and towards large corporations. There were very, very few voices in the party willing to take on the people that funded the party. And I think if you compare it to, say, you know, to now, say, look back 10 years, maybe to 2014, I think very clearly we've moved in the right direction. Now, that doesn't mean that we're better off than we were at various other stages of the Democratic Party. And the incremental movements have been slow. And it certainly feels a little bit ridiculous to be trying to find any hope in the current complexion after just losing so resoundingly in November. But I think to the extent that I have hope, that's what it comes from is, you know, I was coming up, I was going to college, I was going to school, I think in an even bleaker time for the Democrats. And I think, you know, you see that in Annapolis too. And, you know, Larry, I think you'd have to agree. And some of it is your work as an organizer that's made this happen. But I think that progressives have a lot more firm ground to walk on in Annapolis politics and too, in Maryland state politics. And I think, you know, you could probably look across the water to Virginia and see the same thing. You know, the kind of Democrats that were running and that were holding power in Virginia 10, 15, 20 years ago are different than today. The kind of Democrats in Maryland, certainly, who are holding power today versus 10, 15, 20 years ago, there has been a refocus. I wouldn't say to the left. There's been a refocus towards centering working class people first and foremost, rather than just doing the bidding of large corporations and their well-paid lobbyists. Now, we're not all the way there. We still got a lot of progress to go. And I think, you know, in many ways, you know, Maryland could do, you know, make much, much more bolder steps towards making sure that everyone in Maryland is treated with dignity and respect. But if you look at 2024 and you compare it to 2014 or 2004 or 1994 or 1984, I think there's a lot of hope to take from what's happening in both state and national politics.
Yeah, I definitely hear that with what you're saying. Part of it for me, and I know many of our listeners, you know, because I've spoken to many of our listeners, right? And, you know, like there's like a loss of patience with folks, particularly on some of the more urgent issues that we face. And it's looking somewhat bleak at the federal landscape, especially regarding issues like climate change, right? Where now you have like all three branches of government controlled by folks, many of whom who do not believe that climate change is a real issue at all. And that's one of the issues that actually has a clock on it. I mean, do you, like, what do you feel is like the political pathway to be able to address something that has like an actual level of urgency attached to it, like climate change?
Yeah, I mean, I think climate change is certainly urgent, and certainly you're right, has a clock to it, but it's not our only urgent issue. You know, I mean, we've got a lot of folks who are living on the margins in Maryland and DC and in Virginia, who, if we don't make reforms to make sure they can afford healthcare, if we don't make reforms to make sure they can afford housing in the next 2-4 years, then those people may not be with us by the time we've got a chance to elect another Democratic president. So we've got a lot of urgency, including, I think, a lot of vulnerable people's lives in our hands. You know, trans folks needing healthcare, women needing healthcare. I think we've got a lot of urgent issues. And I think the answer to the question is, we've got to look toward the states. Now, obviously, it's a little bit self-serving for me to say that as a state legislator, but it's true that we can't be super hopeful about what's going to happen on the federal level for the next 4 years, and maybe even beyond, if we can't crack any sort of ceiling in the Senate, if we don't fundamentally shake up the Democratic Party brand, if we don't convince folks in rural parts and in multiracial urban cities that the Democratic Party stands for them, then we're never going to be able to get anywhere close to the Senate majority we need to actually enact some of the policies that we know would help working people, like Medicare for All. So, you know, we're at least 4 years away from that realization on the federal level. And so we've got to look local, and we've got to look to state politics. And I think that's a little bit unnatural for a lot of folks to do in the DC area, because we're so inundated with news about the federal government being in its backyard. But at least for the next 4 years, all the action is going to be happening at the state and local level, and we're going to be playing defense on Capitol Hill. And I think Maryland, you know, along with maybe a few other states in the nation, is one of the most interesting places to look right now, because we do have a Democratic supermajority. We do have a Democratic governor in Wes Moore. And even though we have challenging budget issues right now, as you alluded to at the top of the broadcast, there is, I think, a big opportunity for Maryland to show the rest of the country what it looks like to create a state, to create an economy, to create a society that treats everybody with dignity and respect. And I hope we seize that opportunity.
Yeah, I certainly hope so as well. And so I want to bring Dave in here because, of course, we got to bring in, like the context of, what we're also doing here today with lifting up WPFW. And I want to share like a quick story as well. And I promise it all ties together. So like a few years ago, I was like talking to one of the older folks in our community, someone who's been listening to WPFW for quite a while. They're a big jazz fan, actually, and they listen to WPFW a little less for the news and commentary, but just for the music. And they told me they said that without WPFW, I wouldn't have made it through. Not just because of the music, actually, but because they know like that they felt like that jazz like kind of heals the soul. But in addition to that, they appreciated the truth that they heard here on the airwaves, like truth that we're having in this conversation, a different type of dialogue than sometimes you'll hear, like honestly, in mainstream media. And I don't know, like Dave, like have you ever had a chance to like talk to some of our listeners and have they shared any of the reasons why they particularly have kept on listening?
Yeah, I mean the feedback I get is just that we're providing a certain kind of angle on local, state, and national and international news that you're just not likely to hear anywhere else. I mean, when's the last time you recall hearing a Democratic Socialist delegate from the state of Maryland on the airwaves, and he's with us for the whole show? I mean, I just think that speaks mountains to the importance of what we're providing here. And then, of course, the music's extraordinary. I'm out on the road and try and listen to a commercial station, and it's ridiculous. It's interrupted with the capitalist onslaught, and you don't have to fool with that at WPFW. It's just wonderful jazz and blues and all kinds of extraordinary music that you're just not hearing uninterrupted anywhere else. And that's why we're so happy to be a part of this community. Larry's contributing so much in so many ways with Progressive Maryland and being with the station and getting folks like Yvonne Stewart on. I mean, I think it speaks for itself, and then and it refers back to the history of Pacifica, which started in the late 40s. This Pacifica is the first listener-sponsored media, I believe, certainly in the United States, if not the world. This is way before NPR, way before PBS. It's the original model. And it was a while before I realized that Pacifica, it was started by a guy that was a pacifist, Lou Hill. And it's integral to our perspective. And I think particularly with the new administration coming in, or repeat administration, it's going to be extraordinarily important to keep us alive and kicking. And that's why you need to hit that button on your computer, go to WPFWFM.org. You can use your credit card, debit card, PayPal. You can also make the call that makes the difference, 202-588-9739. You can do Cash App, dollar sign, WPFWFM. And we've got a new fangled way to support this community resource, WPFW. You can text WPFWFM to 801-801. And I think I've spoken enough. And gentlemen, take it away.
All right, thank you, Dave. And we've got $300 to go on this pledge drive for our goal for this show. We've just got $300 to go. It looks like here we've got $100 already in. I like to attribute it to my great voice and people maybe liking that or
Oh,
something.
absolutely.
Well, I just want to show appreciation to, whoever has contributed today. And we just have 300 more dollars to go. And that can be done with as a sustainer, that can be done as a one-time contribution. So please contribute into the show. So So bringing it back for a circle, so Delegate Stewart, what role do you feel media has had to play? You mentioned something about whether it's a message problem, that Democrats have in a lack of their ability to get their message to voters, or maybe having the wrong message. And you mentioned where a lot of people talk about whether Kamala Harris should have went on the Joe Rogan show, right? Or paid more close attention to independent media, perhaps independent media like Pacifica or WPFW. But how much of that do you attribute to what's happened to the national Democratic brand?
I think it's a big part of it. I made the case earlier that I think that we need fundamental change to the party brand, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't also get better at talking to people. And I think this radio show and I think shows like it are integral to that. I think what you said about folks tuning in for jazz and then getting a little bit of political commentary that they wouldn't have necessarily heard before on PFW is, I think, gets to the heart of this problem, because we've got to figure out a way to reach voters, as Democrats, reach voters who are not necessarily as engaged as you and me are, Larry. Democrats did very well in the November election amongst voters who pay attention to the news, who read newspapers, who watch cable television shows. And we got waxed with voters who don't. And I think too often, the Democratic response to that reality has been to turn our nose up at certain populations of people and say, oh, well, those folks, clearly they're not smart enough to follow the news. Clearly they got duped by Trump because they're dumb, or they live in this part of the state or this part of the country that we think is undesirable. So we don't even really want their votes anyway. And I think that haughtiness, that arrogance is part of the problem with the Democratic brand, but it's inextricably linked with that communication problem where, there's this attitude of, okay, yeah, we need to win working class votes, but there's this kind of air among elite Democrats of like, well, we got to win their votes even though we don't really like them. And I think part of the issue is we need to connect with people who for whom politics is not their religion, for whom they're much more likely to know, the current stats for Jaden Daniels or Lamar Jackson than they are to know who their own sitting senator is. And we've got to figure out ways to connect with them too. And part of that, the reason that Joe Rogan's show, I think, got a lot of attention is it's not a politics show. And I don't listen to it. I'm not like a fan of his or anything like that. But, he gets on there, he talks about a range of issues with a range of different people, and then he throws politics in to people who wouldn't otherwise tune into a politics podcast. And I think that's what Democrats need to do. Not only Democratic politicians, we need to make sure we're supporting entities like that, but folks in the communications apparatus, like y'all, like you and Dave, who have an interest in making sure we get to not necessarily the strengthening of the Democratic Party, but the strengthening of the working class of this country. We need to find a way through new media channels, through channels that speak to Gen Z, that speak to people that are disaffected. We need to find a way to connect our message to them. And of course, part of that is making sure that our message actually resonates from them, that we're not talking down to people, that we're not treating people like they're stupid, that we're actually giving them policies that will tangibly lift them up. But part of it too is not just the message, but it's the medium. And I think that's what's so important about WPFW.
So, all right. So, kind of switching gears a little bit, and I appreciate your comments on that. I'm sure you've given our listeners a lot to think about with regards to all of this amongst the many, think pieces and retrospective analysis that folks have offered. I really find your perspective refreshing as somebody who's working really in the thick of it at the local level. So, speaking of the local level, so what can we expect? In terms of changing that narrative and changing, the fundamental substance of the Democratic Party, what can we expect here in Maryland, where, unlike at the federal level, you have the complete opposite? You've got each of the branches of government within our state controlled by Democrats. Do you expect any particular policies in this upcoming legislative session to bring some hope for what the Democratic Party can become?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's going to be a lot of reason for folks to tune in to what's happening in Annapolis. The session starts on January 8th. For folks that don't know, the state legislature in Maryland, we meet 3 months out of the year. We have a legislative session that goes through from January through April. It's a 90-day session, and we basically pack 12 months of work into those 3 months. So we got a lot of early mornings and we got a lot of late nights. But I think what's so refreshing about being a lawmaker on the state level rather than the federal level is we actually get stuff done on the state level. The federal government, it seems like they struggle just to rename post offices after people. And every once in a while, a big bill like the Inflation Reduction Act will pass. On the state level, we're passing thousands of bills every single year. So I think it's definitely worth your listeners paying attention to what's happening in Annapolis or what's happening in Richmond and what's happening in DC on the local level. Now, in Maryland, I think, first of all, on sort of the social issue front, you'll see, just like we did after Trump was first elected in 2016, I think you'll see a lot of bills to sort of Trump-proof Maryland. And I think that will involve legislation to protect our immigrants. I think you'll see some more climate legislation this session to make sure at least Maryland's doing its part to try to combat climate change and to try to turn climate change into an opportunity to create jobs. I think you also see Maryland try to shore up its healthcare system in case something happens to the Affordable Care Act on the federal level, in case Republicans are actually successful this time at gutting it or eliminating it. And so I think you'll see a number of those things. That's what we saw in 2017, 2018, 2019, the last time Trump was president. And I think you'll definitely see that kind of legislation coming out of Annapolis and probably coming out of states like California as well. But the big touchstone here, the big showdown this session is going to be on the budget. And Republicans are going to be a bit player. They're certainly going to have a role to play in this conversation. But in large part, it's going to be a conversation between Democrats, between Democratic leadership and the state Senate, in the state House of Delegates where I serve, and with the Democratic governor, Wes Moore. And that conversation is going to revolve around what do we do about two big budgetary gaps that we have in Maryland. We have a structural deficit in our state general fund, our basic budget, and we also have a structural deficit in our transportation trust fund, which pays for not only roads and bridges and transit and sidewalks, but also things like the airports in Maryland, things like the Port of Baltimore. It's a really important fund, and because people are driving more fuel-efficient vehicles, we've had a long structural problem with the transportation trust fund that's been building for years. And so there's a lot of options on the table this session. I think that's going to be the real battle that's going to play out. And I really can't predict exactly which way it's going to go. We have really a series of choices. I think there are two fundamental ones. One, do we kick the can down the road and try to find short-term fixes to the budget problem? And then maybe try to push off hard decisions until after the next election. That's certainly the natural thing that politicians like to do. Or do we break the mold a little bit and do we try to come up with a long-term structural solution to our budgetary woes? Something that actually solves the problem for 6 years or 10 years. So that's the first choice that we've got to make. And obviously, you can probably tell from how I frame that question that I'm in favor of a longer-term solution. I don't think we should just kick the can. I don't think that's fair to our constituents. I don't think people voted me into office for me to take the easy way out and to take the coward's way out. They voted for me to take tough votes and to make tough decisions. The second choice we got to make is even more fundamental, and that's, you alluded to it earlier, Larry, do we balance the budget on the backs of teachers and working people? You know, yeah. Are we going to balance the budget with cuts to education and to health and to transportation, or with regressive taxes that target the working poor? Is that how we're going to choose to balance the budget? That's certainly been something that politicians have done in other states in the past. It's generally easiest when you need budget money to go after people who have less political influence, who can't hire fancy lawyers and fancy lobbyists. Or are we going to balance the budget by closing corporate tax loopholes on corporations that have gotten a free ride for years, and by trying to rebalance our tax system so most of the burden, more of the burden, is on people who have done well, people who have profited from the pandemic, people that have made millions and billions of dollars since the pandemic and who are doing really well? I think that they should be asked to pay a little bit more to make sure that Maryland can continue to be a state with a world-class education system. that Maryland can be a state where it's easy to get to work, where there's transit that actually works, I think that's the direction we should go in. But that's the stakes. That's the showdown. That's what's going to be happening most crucially in Annapolis this session.
Okay, got it. So, I mean, it looks like there's going to be a full plate, on the session in Annapolis. And, you know, from what you're describing, it sounds like it's still a fight in Annapolis, probably even between Democrats to actually deliver on things that would actually, win this popular support of folks this session. So, I mean, I definitely wish you well in that fight. Are there any specific things that you're working on that you want to share with our listeners? And before we get into that, I want to just again say y'all can call in at 202-588-9739. I don't want to forget that. Oh, actually, no, 202-588-0893, but you can donate at that other number. So if you want to join in on the conversation with Delegate Stewart before he goes, please call in at 202-588-0893. So what particularly is going to be like what you're carrying in this legislative session that you would want listeners to know about?
Yeah, absolutely, Larry. Well, first things first, I'm a bit of a masochist in that I put way too many bills in. I introduce a ton of bills every session. And usually that means I pass a good number of bills too. So I feel like at least my constituents are getting their money's worth, because I tend to hustle. And so last session, I think I passed 12 or 13 bills, and I've got another 19, 20 so bills that I'm introducing this session. I'm not going to run through all of them, but I certainly am happy to highlight a couple. The issue areas that I tend to focus most on are transportation, both in terms of now trying to make sure our transportation trust fund is well funded, but also in terms of trying to make sure we have safety on the roads, not just for drivers, but for people who use their feet to get around, people who use transit to get around, and people who use even bikes to get around. So that's going to be another focus of mine, making sure that we've got money to spend on our transportation priorities. And right now, we don't even have money for basic maintenance and repair of the roads. And that's certainly not going to do anything for our safety numbers. Maryland is one of the worst states in the country for traffic crashes and traffic fatalities. So that's one thing I'm going to be focused on with a number of bills this session. The second thing I'm going to focus on is probably been my top issue in Annapolis since I got elected in 2018, which is housing. And I think I don't need to tell your listeners that we have a housing crisis, not only in this country, but in the DMV, and especially Montgomery, Prince George's County, places around D.C. In Maryland, we have a really, really stark housing crisis. And that's something that I've tried to tackle with a series of bills for the last several years to not only boost the affordable housing supply, to build more housing, especially where we need it the most near transit stops, but also to make sure we are taking care of tenants as well. Last session, I passed a landmark bill called the Tenant Safety Act, which makes it easier for tenants to take their disputes with their slumlords to court, specifically around habitability issues, because we have too many Marylanders that we know are living in deplorable conditions that their landlords are allowing to exist. So we're talking about folks living with rats and with sewage and with no AC in the summer, no heat in the winter. And so that bill last session, we're going to try to keep building on to make sure that there are tenant protections in place. One bill that I'll be putting forward this session involves source of income discrimination, where landlords will oftentimes discriminate against folks who have Section 8 vouchers. Another issue that I'm focused on a lot is just consumer protection laws generally. And I've got a couple of bills around making sure that, for example, there's not sneaky clauses and provisions in consumer contracts that people don't even know, they don't even read before they sign, but then they unwittingly give away some of their legal rights and remedies when they sign those. Another bill involving climate that I'm going to be putting forward stops Marylanders from subsidizing trash incineration. Larry, I know you know about this. I don't know how many listeners know about this, but for the last several years, Maryland has this provision where when you pay your utility bill every month, you're supposed to be, some of that money is supposed to go to clean, renewable energy. But how the state has defined renewable energy includes a lot of dirty energy sources, including, wildly enough, trash burning, trash incineration. Oh, yeah. And it looks like this session is going to be finally the time that we're going to, looks like the Senate President Bill Ferguson in Baltimore City is going to be working on this with me. And it looks like we're finally going to be taking that out so that we can put our dollars towards things that are actually renewable and actually create jobs like wind energy, and not towards just giving these handouts to large corporations that burn trash and pollute the air. So that's a little taste of what I'm doing. But in general, I'm going to be focused primarily on affordability. We just got to make sure that Marylanders can afford their lives. We've got, you know, population loss starting to creep in the state of Maryland, and we can't be a welcoming place and we can't be a productive place if we're not an affordable place. And that's going to be, I think, my focus, and also I think the focus of the Democrats in the House of Delegates this session.
Yeah, I mean, that, so you got a full plate this year coming up in front of you, and I look forward to joining you, particularly on the trash incineration work. We've been doing some great organizing in Baltimore City, actually in Senator Ferguson's district, to, you know, work towards closing that incineration plant over there. So it's fantastic. Well, I want to thank you, Delegate Stewart, for joining us today. I want to also mention, you know, maybe because you are just that special of a guest, we are actually above our goal. Dave has been keeping track of the numbers for people contributing to the show, and I think they like you a whole lot, Delegate Stewart. So Dave, you want to share what's going on with our goal for this pledge drive? I think you're trying to get off of mute, but you're not succeeding at getting off of mute. We got to get the button working for you. Well, maybe I can share while Dave is trying to work on his microphone.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, I can hear you now.
Can you hear me, Larry?
Yes, I can.
Great.
So we are over.
I just want to thank our wonderful listeners. We went over our goal. Particularly want to thank Eugene Ronald and Wayne Kahn for their support. It's so reassuring and exciting to have our listeners contribute to this vital community resource that is WPFW. I think Larry just had a wonderful guest on that gives us a lot of insights, what's happening locally as well as nationally. Very important. Yvonne Stewart, really appreciate his participation today. And, you know, I think it's an example of this show and the station's example. We're kind of countering of the insidious effects of capitalism, you know, be it commercials on the airwaves, be it how it affects our government, how it affects our economic functioning, even how we perceive each other. As a, you know, we tend to commoditize each other. And I think it's a functioning part of our economic system. And WPW stands as a counterweight to that. We are not about making the God Almighty dollar. We're about providing wonderful cultural resources and information to our listeners. And we really want to thank thank you all for your support, and thank Larry today. It was a terrific show, sir.
Yes, and thank you all once again for joining us, and yeah, for helping us get over that goal. I mean, if y'all want to continue to help, you know, push us even further over the goal, we don't mind at all. But definitely thank you to Wayne, Eugene, and all those who contributed to today's show, and those who keep WPFW afloat, and more than just afloat, thriving as an institution for what we do in our community. So thank y'all once again. And I think that's a wrap for our show, for this episode here. I want to thank Delegate Stewart and all of the WPFW volunteers who help keep the show going at the station as well. Thank you for tuning in. And we'll be back on with Dave in the new year. Is that right, Dave? We'll be right back at the top of the year. Oh, you're on mute.
Good. I'm going to be on twice, Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve.
Okay.
11 Christmas o'clock, Eve. And we'll have some interesting program for you.
Okay. That is fantastic. So tune right back in, you know, Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve, you know, to hear the holiday special with Dave Rabin, a Community Watch and Comment. So I know you got a lot to look forward with that. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and stay involved. Thanks for listening, and have a wonderful holiday season.
Radio, I'm Scott Baba. A senior Russian general has been killed by a bomb hidden outside his apartment building in Moscow. The attack came a day after Ukraine's security service leveled criminal charges against him. Donna Warder reports.
Lieutenant General Igor Kirillov was head of Russia's nuclear, biological, and chemical defense forces, and he was killed by a bomb today, one day after Ukraine's security agency charged him with using banned chemical weapons during Russia's military operation in Ukraine. A Ukrainian official says the country's security service carried out the attack, and the bomb, which was hidden in a scooter outside Kirillov's apartment building in Moscow, went off as the general left for his office. His assistant also was killed. Russian news reports say the bomb was triggered remotely. Kirillov was under sanctions from several countries, including the UK and Canada, for his actions in Moscow's war in Ukraine. I'm Donna Warder.
After months of deadlock, Israel and Hamas appear to be moving closer towards a ceasefire to end their 14-month war. Top officials from the U.S., Qatar, and Egypt have resumed their mediation efforts in recent weeks and reported greater willingness by the warring sides to wrap up a deal. In a key concession, Hamas officials say they are prepared to show more flexibility on the timing of an Israeli troop withdrawal from Gaza. Israel's Defense Minister Israel Katz said yesterday that a deal is closer than ever. The agreement is expected to take place in phases and include a halt in fighting, an exchange of captive Israeli hostages for Palestinian prisoners, and a surge in aid to Gaza. Cyclone Chido, a Category 4 storm, tore through the southwestern Indian Ocean over the weekend, hitting northern Madagascar before intensifying and slamming the French island of Mayotte with winds exceeding 136 miles per hour. This according to France's weather service. Chido later moved into northern Mozambique, causing further damage before weakening. French President Emmanuel Macron said he will travel to Mayotte as rescue teams rush to locate the missing. The Interior Minister says the French island was devastated after Cyclone Chido hit the territory. At least 20 people have been confirmed dead, but authorities fear that hundreds, if not thousands, of people could have died in the disaster. Ross Collin reports.
The French Interior Minister says the island of Mayotte has been completely devastated. Bruno Retailleau added that there is, quote, nothing left of the shanty towns. Mayotte is struggling in the aftermath of the worst cyclone to hit the island in almost 100 years. The president says he will be traveling to the Indian Ocean territory in the coming days, and the race is on to locate survivors and provide water, food and shelter, and also to try to prevent the spread of disease. Ross Cullen, Paris.
Police say a 15-year-old student opened fire inside a study hall at a small Christian school in Wisconsin, killing a teacher and a teenager. Jennifer King reports.
The shooter died on the way to the hospital. Police say she apparently took her own life.
A second-grade student called 911 at 10:57 a.m.
Madison Police Chief Sean Barnes.
Three people, including the shooter, are dead. The shooter has now been identified as 15-year-old Natalie Rupnow.
Six others were wounded, including two students who were in critical condition. A teacher and three students had less serious injuries.
I know that my daughter is safe.
Bethany Hyman was among the parents who rushed to Abundant Life Christian School.
I pray for the hearts of the students, the teachers, the staff members.
A motive for the shooting was not immediately known. Police are talking to the shooter's family and searching the home. In a statement, the White House said President Joe Biden had been briefed on the shooting and cited the tragedy in calling on Congress to pass stricter gun safety measures. I'm Jennifer King.
President-elect Donald Trump sued the Des Moines Register and pollster J.N. Seltzer yesterday, alleging fraud over a pre-election poll showing Vice President Kamala Harris leading in Iowa. The poll, released days before Election Day, showed Harris ahead by 3 points. Trump ultimately won the state by 14 points. The lawsuit by 14 points. The lawsuit filed in Polk County accuses Seltzer and the Register of deception under Iowa's consumer fraud laws, claiming the poll was intentional.